I am Ben Rao. I currently work for the USDA Forest Service in Aiken, South Carolina. But when I did this work, I was a postdoc with the Pasture Systems and Watershed Management Research Unit up at the ARS office in State College, Pennsylvania. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about spatial and temporal variation in N2O emissions from perennial grass bioenergy production systems grown on marginal soils. And in this case, marginal soil is defined as poorly drained soils with seasonally inundated high water table, things of that nature. This work was primarily funded by the USDA and also by the Sun Grant Initiative, and some of my partners with this are Dr. Paul Adler, Curtis Dell, and Armin Kamanian from both the USDA and Penn State University. So why are we interested in N2O? Most of you probably know this already, but N2O has something like 300 times the 100-year atmospheric heat-trapping potential of CO2, which makes it a very important greenhouse gas. And N2O is responsible for about roughly 16% of atmospheric heat-trapping at this point in time. It's also the single most significant ozone-destroying gas emitted to the atmosphere. It's no longer CFCs from aerosols and things of that nature. And it's the largest source. N fertilizer is the largest source of N2O emissions globally, and it's roughly 78% of all N2O emissions in the United States. So it's pretty important. How is N2O formed? It's formed through a host of different microbial processes. Denitrification is the one that probably most people think about, but it's also formed through nitrification, heterotrophic nitrification, and aerobic denitrification. It's also formed through nitrifier denitrification and through coupled nitrification denitrification. So, and a lot of these processes overlap depending on where you are with soil oxygen content, increasing the amount of N in the soil and the amount of carbon content in the soil. So there's a lot of overlap there, and there's a lot of different processes by which N2O can actually be formed. This is kind of another way to look at it. So the most common way that people think about it, I think, is in relation to soil moisture content. You think about anaerobic versus aerobic conditions, and if you have aerobic conditions, I think a lot of people think of autotrophic nitrification, and when you get into these anaerobic conditions, you think a lot more about heterotrophic denitrification. And so this is kind of a graphic looking at N2O production versus water-filled pore space, which is kind of a surrogate for soil moisture or aerobic processes. And you can see that the autotrophic nitrification probably accounts for most of N2O production up until about 50% water-filled pore space, at which case denitrification starts to kick in. So once you start to get a lot of water in the pore space and you start to reduce the oxygen content, you get into these more anoxic conditions, then denitrification becomes a more important process. Or at least so the theory goes, right? The hypothesis. And so what does all this have to do with bioenergy production and marginal soils? Well, marginal soils are often sources of N2O due to their higher moisture content. And on a lot of these soils, annual row crops are really poorly suited for these type of lands. So many are often converted to pastures or placed in conservation easements. Think of like the CRP, the CREP program, things of that nature. And it's been suggested that perennial grasses for bioenergy could be an effective and economic alternative to either leaving these lands fallow or as pasture or as conservation easements. And right now, the most interest lies in two particular grasses, I would say. Switchgrass, Panicum virginum, and Miscanthus, or Miscanthus giganteus. One is North American native, while one is not. Typically Miscanthus can produce, a third more to twice as much biomass as switchgrass, depending on where it's grown. Switchgrass establishes relatively easy from seed, whereas Miscanthus needs to be established from rhizomes. Switchgrass is a little bit more tolerant of drier conditions, whereas the Miscanthus seems to thrive in some of these more moist environments. So we wanted to kind of compare these two grasses on some of these marginal soils. Now, we essentially want to know, can perennial grass bioenergy crops be grown on marginal soils, produce bioenergy feedstock, reduce N2O emissions, and essentially what are the factors that influence N2O emissions there? So one of the other things is essentially, do you need to fertilize these crops? Do you need to not fertilize these crops? And by fertilizing them or not fertilizing them, what impact does this have on N2O emissions, water quality? We also did some water quality work, but I won't present that here today. So this is the site. It was a single site. It was at least for this research, and it was done in a single year. We'd wanted to continue this over time, but it turned out we moved on to bigger and better things. But we do have the data from 1 year. This is central Pennsylvania. This is a landscape typical of the Ridge and Valley Province in the Appalachian Mountains, typical upland portion of the Chesapeake Bay watershed, a lot of dairy farms, things like that. And so in the foreground of this picture, you can see your typical field, I just came from Tifton, Georgia, so I'm thinking cotton soybean. But this is a corn-soybean rotation on the upland portions of the landscape. You get into the lower portions of the landscape down around the riparian zone. And those are these areas that are underlain by these poorly drained soils, what they call fragipan up there. So water infiltrates into the upper portions of the landscape as it hits the slope break in this area here. It typically hits this fragipan. It comes up to the surface. These are poorly drained, water inundated soils, not really ideally suited for row crop production. And so a lot of them, like, as we mentioned, had been just reverting back to grass or put into conservation easements. So in that area there, we set up a complete randomized block study where we looked at the control, which is essentially this timothy grass or this pasture type grass, and it's mixed in with whatever else gets growing there. We then looked at switchgrass with no nitrogen additions, switchgrass grown with 50 kilograms per hectare of nitrogen additions in the form of ammonium phosphate. We also looked at switchgrass grown with manure, poultry manure in this case, and we looked at switchgrass grown in the presence of legumes. And then we compared that to miscanthus treatment where zero N was applied. These plots were originally established in 2011 and had to be partially replanted in 2012. And then the data you're going to see today comes from 2013. So it's essentially the third growing season into the experiment. We sunk three shallow wells into each one of these plots. Each one of these plots measures roughly 40 feet by 40 feet. There's also two gas flux measurements in each plot located near the center of each plot. These are static chamber gas flux measurements. Those are taken twice weekly throughout the growing season. There were two shallow tension lysimeters inserted near the gas flux measurements. These are essentially designed to pull soil solution. Those were collected every time we took a gas flux measurement. We used Campbell Scientific CS616 probes to measure soil moisture on hourly increments throughout the growing season, and we also used these Apogee soil oxygen sensors to measure soil oxygen on 1 hour increments throughout the growing season in near surface soils. So kind of measuring all the things that you'd be interested in: soil moisture, soil temperature, soil oxygen, soil solution nitrate and ammonium concentrations associated with N2O emissions. And this is kind of all the aggregate data from the growing season in 2013. The blue line represents the water-filled pore space as measured with the soil moisture sensors. The green line actually represents the soil oxygen percent as measured with the Apogee sensors. Red dots are the N2O emissions, and these kind of turquoise dots then are the soil solution nitrate that we pulled from the tension lysimeters. And so you can see the soil moisture picks up on all the different precipitation events and drying events throughout the growing season. You can also see when you get big spikes in soil moisture, you start to actually create anoxic conditions. And this is our fertilization event right here at the beginning of the growing season. Again, this is the aggregate data for all the data combined. So it's the mean of all the different treatments. And you can see essentially what we get is here's the data fertilization. You get two good measurements of N2O emissions and then flatline for the rest of the year. So most of the N2O emissions occurred immediately after fertilization. And you can see even after the fertilization event, there's this big drying event, and in particular you get this first precipitation event, and that's where your emissions occur. So you break this down then into kind of treatment effects, looking at soil solution nitrate, soil solution NH4, and nitrous oxide emissions. So these symbols are a little bit difficult to see, but you can see the black is the control, the red is the miscanthus, green triangles are switchgrass without fertilizer, and the yellow triangles are the switchgrass with fertilizer. There's also switchgrass with legumes and switchgrass with manure. And early in the growing season, before we fertilize, you can actually see that soil solution nitrate is relatively high in a lot of these treatments, but N2O emissions are relatively low. And then after the fertilization event, nitrate actually decreases, but again, that was kind of part of that drying trend that we saw back here. You can see kind of drying trend that's occurring. And then you get that first precipitation event and soil solution nitrate spikes big time in the switchgrass, to the fertilized switchgrass, and also in the manure plots. But it disappears relatively quickly, and then it's gone. And so this is also right around the point in time of the year where the temperatures are heating up and the grass is really starting to grow and uptake is occurring relatively rapidly. So you can see the spike in nitrous oxide emissions doesn't actually occur until you get that first precipitation event after fertilization, and then you get a big pulse of N2O emissions, and then it's gone. And so this is kind of looking at this was the temporal distribution of N2O emissions and how it relates to soil solution nitrate and ammonium. Each one of these plots, each one of the gas flux measurements had a geo-referenced location. And so, you know, these are every place that a measurement actually took place. You know, this is the randomized complete block design. So this is the day that we fertilized. This was, the day after we fertilized, May 31st. And as we go through time, you can see, you know, some very low emissions show up here. You can see these greenish blobs. You go into June 4th, there's almost nothing. You go into June 7th, here things start to occur in the switchgrass with manure plots, the switchgrass, fertilized switchgrass plots, but it's not ubiquitous, it's not everywhere. And you can see even one ring to the next, there's some spatial variation that occurs here. And then you can see things shift around a little bit. You get big emissions from these two plots. Things calm down in other spots. And these are basic, this is using ArcGIS, these are basic spatial statistics, common kriging techniques. And by June 14th, it's over. And then there's nothing for the rest of the growing season, or very little. And so this is all the data. So what we expect, what we're hoping to find is that, you know, you make these measurements of nitrate, ammonium, moisture, temperature, oxygen, and nitrous oxide emissions, and you produce some really nice graph of correlations and relationships, and it you know, linear relationships and things like that, and it just doesn't work out that way. What it looks like is more like these are threshold type events. So what we saw moving this way, this is nitrous oxide emissions going this way. The blue dots are water-filled pore space. The green dots are actually soil oxygen, and the pink dots are the soil nitrate measurements. So you can see, I mean, a lot of nothing going on here. But then as you move over this way, you can see there's kind of a threshold here at about 5 or 6 parts per million nitrate, where most of your big emissions occur over that threshold. Most of them have water-filled pore spaces on this axis, so it's water-filled pore space, typically over 50%. Is where most of your nitrous oxide emissions occur. And oddly enough, so this is the soil oxygen percent, and most of the emissions actually occur when there's relatively high levels of oxygen in the soil, right? Not when it's 0% oxygen, as you would expect if you're looking at denitrification. And so is there any benefit really to fertilizing? Well, and in one particular growing season in 2013, what we saw that switchgrass 50N, switchgrass grown with legume, switchgrass grown with manure, and switchgrass 0N, there was no difference in biomass production. But miscanthus production was almost 60% higher. So in conclusion, fertilizer increased N2O emissions relative to other treatments. N2O emissions were highest immediately after fertilization, particularly when inorganic fertilizer was applied. The N2O emissions were more closely related to soil solution nitrate than to ammonium, so I did actually do some bunch of regressions with all the data, and it's more closely related to nitrate than ammonium. N2O emissions occurred when water-filled pore space exceeded 50%, and when soil solution nitrate was above 6 parts per million. N2O emissions were not heterogeneous or across the landscape, and were highly influenced by microsite conditions. And we're working on that right now, looking at a fine-scale DEM of this site to kind of see what type of topography might have influenced what was going on here. But fertilizing switchgrass with manure, inorganic N, or growing in combination with legumes didn't really increase the yield, and miscanthus and switchgrass grown without N appear to be as effective as the conservation grassland at reducing N2O emissions. So a lot of what we found down here was that these were essentially not different than the control treatment, which was the cool season grass treatment.
I have one quick question. Just one thought.
Sure.
Since there was no response to the nitrogen fertilization, do you feel like the nitrogen demand for switchgrass has exceeded the amount of fertilizer, and maybe that also contributes to the nitrogen potential?
I have a hypothesis, but we need to follow up on it with like tracer tests. Is that, you know, this field is typically fertilized with manure, you know, this corn soybean, and you're getting a lot of nitrate leaching that's occurring here. It's traveling through the subsurface into this area of marginal soils here, and that's probably satisfying demand for nitrogen by these plants. But again, this is one growing season, and we don't have a lot of other data that supports that.
What year of development?
Year 3. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.